Hello and welcome to episode 206 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino. Episode 206?
206-ness. It's really kind of sad that this milestone comes so soon after episode 200, because it deserves to be played up more.
This is the most important episode. Episode 206, this is when the clip show happens. So run it now. The real clip show.
Oh, no. It's going to be a clip show of fake clips, like on Community. Or unseen clips, I guess. Yeah, my original plan was I thought we should have a big interview for episode 206, but then there turned out to be a pandemic. So decided I wanted to save those interviews for later, as it turns out.
Honestly, couldn't the global pandemic have considered episode 206 of the Fabulous Podcast?
It really didn't even think about it. But again, because of the pandemic, we continue to socially distance. I am coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Rent, Washington, home of your Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
But not, are you guys aren't 206, are you?
I'm not 206?
Well, like, Renton wouldn't technically be 206, would it? Obviously, you have a 206 area code.
I was born in the 206, and I will die in the 206.
Oh, okay. Are you going to get a 206 tattoo? There's an NBA player who has a 206 tattoo, right?
Probably.
There's got to be.
I typed in a Renton Y area code, and it said area code 425.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely not in the 206 anymore.
I'll have to return home to Boulevard Park to die.
I'm not finding anything on a 206 area code tattoo. No, wait a second.
Hello, Jason Terry, Jamal Crawford.
No, it's not being an NBA player. It's just a 206 tattoo.
Just a person with a 206 tattoo. Well, toast to them also. Yeah. That's what episode 206 is for.
There you go. What are we toasting with this week?
I am toasting with, because it's on our 206th episode, we have to go local, of course. And from our good friends at Two Beers Brewing Company in Georgetown, Washington, I have the Other Coast. It's not the third best sandwich restaurant in Seattle. It is a seasonal hazy IPA from Two Beers.
Did the Other Coast win the fan vote? I did that for the Clips episode. I've already forgotten.
I have no idea. I listened to it at the Clips episode and it's gone. Maybe we've drank too many of these hazy IPAs.
It's been a long 6 weeks. Let's be clear.
It really has. And you're like, that's. I was like, I remember that being 130 years ago.
I mean, we released that episode. The 200th episode was released the day before Rudy Gobert tested positive. So that was a very long time ago, as it turns out. Anyways,
wow.
You picked up for me from Cloudburst Brewing. Actually, I got to double check what the name of this is here.
Our good friends at Cloudburst Brewing. It doesn't say it on the can.
It does not say it, but I texted it to you.
While you look that up, I will read you about the Other Coast Seasonal Hazy IPA.
Okay.
Tropical, citrusy, and verdant. This hazy IPA's aroma is bursting with guava, pineapple, and citrus peel. Notes of orange pith, never lemon, Meyer lemon, and soft vanilla ester on the palate give way to a pleasantly clean and lightly bitter finish. Look,
you want to just do that over again? Oh, boy. All right.
Wait. I'm actually going to do that again because that was really bad. I said never lemon.
No, we got to leave it in now.
No McIlvain. Maybe even Bellevue.
I have the OK But Just This Once IPA from Cloudburst Brewing,
right,
with Mosaic, Amarillo, Simcoe, Chinook, and Cascade hops. Of course,
there we
Cascade.
Go.
I cracked one of these open yesterday. Quite good. Quite good.
But is it verdant?
It may not be verdant. It may not be that.
I don't mean to insult anybody else, but I think Cloudburst might be the best brewery in Seattle.
Wow, excluding nobody?
Excluding nobody.
Yeah, I'm still going Fremont. Sorry.
Fremont is very good. They have a lot of beers now. Cloudburst, drinking some of their like pretty heavy IPAs, they are just so smooth. I woke up the next morning after drinking a fair amount of Cloudburst beer and had quite the headache. I was like, that is a lot more hops than a Rainier Tallboy.
Did you go with the 16-ounce 4-pack?
Yes, and then I also got a Crowler, a 32-ounce Crowler.
Okay, I was curious about that. Well, as usual, let's toast everyone who is out there on the front lines working to make sure that we're able to stay at home and stay safe and try to continue flattening this curve, especially the frontline medical personnel. So cheers to you. So we're done with the Peltoncast Hall of Fame. This week we're just going to get right into Let's Remember Some Years, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza, our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci is from the 206, and so are we.
There you go. By the way, I picked up some Pagliacci Pizza earlier tonight. Went for a combo PSR and then the Grand Salami.
There we go.
Half and half. That was quite delicious.
I have had a lot of Pagliacci Pizza lately. Maybe I should put together some notes. Because every Friday I've been getting Pagliacci and getting two different pizzas and then also like getting a half. So it's basically three pizzas every time. And I want to maybe do some rankings. I've had quite a few of their seasonals. Yeah.
They do have new seasonals now going on here.
I got one of those. One is a bacon leek pizza.
Yeah. That's what you got?
I got that on Friday.
What was the review?
It's pretty good.
It's sounding like it's not going to be at the top of the rankings.
It's not going to be at the top of the rankings. I'm a little bit more of a traditionalist when it comes to pizza. I mean, the things that I really like at Pagliacci are like ricottas and goat cheeses and stuff like that. And I do like the olive oil base. I'm not sure how much I like the arugula. It doesn't get gross, but like the arugula is very good when it's fresh. And then, you know, by the time you're eating it 20 minutes later or reheating it the next day, the arugula loses some of its luster, I guess is what I'll say.
That makes sense. So the other, that one also features Beecher's Flagship White Cheddar, the other seasonal.
Which is excellent.
Of course. The other seasonal tomato basil made with Roma tomatoes roasted in olive oil, balsamic vinegar, and herbs. All right, let's get into 2006. So 2006 in Seattle sports. Last year we had these three amazing stories. This year, a darker time period.
This
the
is
biggest
the
story.
Not quite the darkest time.
Oh, it gets much darker.
Second darkest time. Yeah.
But and the biggest story comes off the court when, on July 18th, the Sonics are sold to a group of investors from Oklahoma City. Dun, dun, dun. I mean, this story really goes back throughout all of 2006. We talked last week about the Seahawks playing in the Super Bowl because it was part of the 2005 season, but of course it occurred in February 2006. The week of that game, Sonics majority owner Howard Schultz held a pregame press conference complaining about the lack of support in the Washington State Legislature for the team's proposal to renovate Key Arena and threatened the possibility of a sale or move. "We have no alternative," Schultz said. "This is not a philanthropic venture. We're not trying to make money. We just want to stop losing it." The next week, Sports Illustrated wrote about the possibility of a move, including reporting that Wally Walker at that point had met with representatives from the arena in San Jose, which I believe at the time was the Compax. Nah, I don't know what it was, but it's now the HP Arena in San Jose.
It's the no basketball arena.
It certainly is. And that was where Seattle City Council member Nick Licata was quoted as saying about the Sonics potentially moving and the impact of that. "On an economic basis, near zero. On a cultural basis, close to zero. We would still have two sports, and plenty of cities our size don't have three." Thanks, Nicol Cotta.
This is... Nicol Cotta is one of the many bad guys in this situation, but... I mean, the way that Nicol Cotta is viewing this is kind... It's ridiculous, but we've already talked about the greatest villain in 2006.
So later that month, David Stern visited Olympia to lobby the legislature for arena funding, saying, "A substantial amount has been done for the baseball and football teams. I'm here personally to find out whether the same is being considered fairly for the NBA. If not, that's a decision we can accept, but then we'll have to act on it ourselves." The session passed without progress, and I mean, the thing you have to remember about 2006, we've talked about this in the past, but like, everyone just assumed the Mariners got saved at the 11th hour in 95. The Seahawks literally had moving vans at their headquarters in the Kirkland at that point in either 95 or 96, around that same time. And everyone just assumed the exact same thing is going to happen here in Seattle. This will, you know, you have to threaten to move or sell the team because that's just part of the process. But then all of a sudden in July, it wasn't. Do you have any memories of the day of the sale?
Yeah, I remember sitting in my childhood bedroom and reading about it. I went to ESPN.com on the front page, and it was like Sonic sold, and I was like, oh crap, what's this? Everybody started panicking, and then you coming back and being like, it's fine, it's not a big deal, they want to keep the team in Seattle. And I was like, oh well, as I often do, I just blindly went along with what you said.
I don't feel like I would have said that it's fine.
You were much less concerned than almost anybody else. You were like, this local news media is freaking out about nothing.
Let's put this in context. Like,
oh, okay.
The way that it was being discussed by a lot of people was like, again, the moving trucks are here. The team is going to be in Oklahoma City by the end of the week, which was not true. But, I mean, I don't think I ever would have said it was fine.
Let's discuss this in context. The team moved to Oklahoma City after being sold to an ownership group from Oklahoma City. The person who executed the sale had disappeared by the time the sale had happened. It was an old-fashioned grift. And, like, it happened right in front of us, and it happened in 2006. This 2006 was the end of professional basketball in Seattle.
I mean, yes, it was the beginning of the end, but, you know, we did get a season of Kevin Durant. Like, I'm not going to, like, wipe that off the face of, you know, out of Seattle basketball history.
Okay, I may have a Kevin Durant Sonics bobblehead sitting right next to me, but I almost would rather that had never happened.
I mean, I get what you're saying, but I still would rather it happen. So I've told the story before, but I went to work that morning, had no idea what was happening. You know, only a select group of employees did. I know David Locke has said that he was called in the night before to kind of like do a mock press conference or, you know, Q&A to prepare for it. But I was not called in after the Sonic softball game we had the night before, which was also a big part of the summer of 2006. So the Storm were playing.
They were like, let the boys rest. They had a big softball game.
Well, like, our vice president of sales and marketing, who would have been at that late night preparation, came to the softball game that night.
Who was your nemesis team? Like something steel?
Bell and Sheet Metal.
You know, they just got rocked by Ballard Sheet Metal last night. Let's let them have the night off.
And this was before that. That was later in the season. Because this was also, or no, I guess it might have been towards the end of the season.
Another terrible thing that happened in 2006.
It was after we played the doubleheader on the night of the 2006 draft. And I obviously did not participate in those games. But the players who did got heckled about the Moseta pick.
They got hecked by Ballard Sheet Metal?
Not Ballard Sheet Metal, whoever they were playing. Anyway,
I gotta say, whoever they were playing was right.
Ballard Sheet Metal, though, like, we just kind of joked all season that they were going to be our rival, but then we actually did, like, there was some tension with Ballard Sheet Metal. They're a rough team, man.
They're a sheet metal company.
We were out here in, like, our super professional jerseys because the manager of the team shop was one of our players. And then we win one game all season. But guess who scored the game-winning run in that game? This guy.
Wow. There you go.
One of my rare highlights that season. Anyways, much better than the time that I got hit in the back with a softball while running from first to second, that they were trying to throw me out at second, and collapsed to the ground as if, like, something terrible had happened to me. And this must have been our first game, because I was still wearing shorts. I hadn't bought or hadn't gotten baseball pants. And I skinned my knees so badly because I went, like, knee first into second base. That was painful for weeks afterwards. Really, really a rough. Anyways, that day I go in, don't
Will
know
you
anything.
Stop at nothing, 2006.
I know. The Storm were playing their kids' day game at noon against the Sacramento Monarchs. And so I'm planning to go up there, walk up there at like 10. And my boss calls me into his office probably around 9:45 or maybe right at 10 and gives me the news. And so I have to walk up to this game and plan to cover this game, knowing that the Sonics have been sold to a group from Oklahoma City. The only other person in the arena at that point, well, I guess it probably was PR people who knew, but was Ann Donovan. And I remember she just looked like pale as a, you know, like a ghost, the late Ann Donovan, in her pregame media ability, although she also deal with the fact that Lauren Jackson was injured and out for that game, and the Storm ended up losing. And the news broke a little before halftime, and by the second half, there was like Oklahoma is not okay signs in the lower bowl already. And
wow.
Walked over from that game to the Furtado Center, the Storm, Sonics and Storm practice facility, for the press conference. Yeah, that was thankful. I didn't have to write anything about the press conference, because I just was done emotionally at that point. And the story I wrote about it when I wrote about this a few years ago on an anniversary was, I went to go play basketball at the church near our house. And there was this guy there who I never had seen before, never saw him again. Only time was like, I'm new in town, and he's shooting around. And he goes, yeah, it's a shame I'm new here, and I'm never going to get to see the Sonics play because they're going to move. And I did
and
not.
You were like, they'll have at least two more lame duck seasons.
And I did not tell him that I worked for the Sonics. It was the only time. Only time I've ever obfuscated about where I worked.
You'll be like, just wait, buddy. They're going to trade a Hall of Famer for Jeff Green, and you'll get to see 1 year of Kevin Durant. He'll be ripped away from you.
Oh boy!
Chin up. Oh man.
One happier news. Let's talk about the 2006 Seahawks. I don't know if they necessarily are happier news.
Sort of.
Coming off,
news?
They had some good moments at the end. We'll talk about. So from the 2005 team that reached the Super Bowl, they lost Steve Hutchinson to a poison pill offer sheet from the Minnesota Vikings, but of course responded in kind by issuing a similar poison pill offer sheet to restricted free agent Nate Burleson to bring him
out. There you go.
I don't know if he's 206's finest, but we're going to consider him that for now. Then, after opening the season with a 9-6 win over the Lions with no receiver with more than 52 yards receiving, the Seahawks trade a first-round pick to the New England Patriots for... Maybe for wide receiver Deion Branch, who had been holding out. And this was so exciting to us because we didn't understand draft picks yet.
Yeah. Look, we weren't smart football fans. We probably were for 2006 standards. But like,
he was the Super Bowl MVP. I thought so. Okay.
Trading for Deion Branch right then was like, all right, everything's okay again. We're going back to another Super Bowl. We've got Deion Branch.
I mean, the main thing I remember is that for at least two solid weeks, every time we saw each other, we did not say hello. We greeted each other with Deion Branch.
It's rare that that happens. Not since Percy Harvin have we done that. but a question for you about that I've never understood about the Steve Hutchinson poison pill offer sheet.
Shoot.
The deal with it was he a restricted free agent?
Yes.
So he was a restricted free agent, and the Vikings put in this clause. Can you still do this, by the way?
I think they have outlawed this, which was not allowed at the time in the NFL, or in the NBA, I mean.
Which is, like, whatever. If he plays so many games in the state of Washington or something, his contract goes up to something massive.
I think that's what they did with Nate Burleson.
State of
Minnesota. The the provision in the Vikings offer was that there was like some sort of enormous bonus if he wasn't the highest paid offensive lineman on the team.
Oh, so it's basically like a Walt Jones factor.
Yes, Wikipedia says it would have guaranteed his entire salary if he was not the highest paid lineman on his own team. So there you go.
Which is really, like, when you think back on Steve Hutchinson's career, he's a Hall of Fame offensive lineman who was really young at the time. Would that have been that bad to have guaranteed his entire salary?
Yeah, it's fair. I would not. I mean, you would have risked injury, which is always possible. But
I mean, there should be guaranteed contracts in the NFL to begin with. So
yes, I under.
But okay, here's my question. That is not my question.
Okay.
My question is, why did Steve Hutchinson want to play in Minnesota so badly that he was willing to agree to this? Because all that you're stopping is the Seahawks from matching the same offer sheet, right? He's not getting more money by going to Minnesota.
This is and a great question. And
that's what has never made sense to me. Is it just like he was so desperate to get out of Seattle? Or like, I mean, I know he was from the Midwest. It kind of makes sense. But he wasn't signing with the Packers, right? Like,
yeah, I don't know. And he's back on good terms with the Seahawks organization. He now is working as a scout for the Seahawks.
Really?
Yeah.
It's still Steve Hutchinson more than any of the Seahawks. Well, I guess actually quite a few players in this time period. I have mixed feelings about a lot of players, but more than any player who's not Sean Alexander, I still have mixed feelings about, because it's like, why do that? Why after a Super Bowl year? And look, the reason that the Seahawks were worse after this and so slowly faded away probably had nothing to do with Steve Hutchinson.
I don't know that I would agree with that. Their offensive line got substantially worse the next year.
So I just don't get that piece of it, where it's like, I understand it from the Vikings' perspective, but like for him, if the Seahawks match, that's a good thing, right?
It does seem that way, but maybe the Vikings wouldn't have been willing to make him that offer if they thought the Seahawks might match it.
Because, so then what?
So, like, I'm saying that, like, they wouldn't be willing to pay him as much money knowing that the Seahawks might be able to match it. So that contingent on
I think there are faults on both sides there, though. I think there is.
There was lot of talk at the time that Tim Ruskell, who was the Seahawks GM at that point, did not believe in paying for a guard, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think both of those things, losing a player like Steve Hutchinson because of something like that. Like, look, if it's something crazy, whatever, but just not guaranteeing a salary, which I suppose in 2006 terms is unheard of. NFL is definitely moving a slight bit closer to that. But it does not make sense to me.
In 2005, Matt Hasselbeck was sacked on 5.1% of draftbacks. In 2006, he was sacked on 8.4% of his dropbacks.
Wow.
And was injured at one point that season, as we'll get to in a second here. The Seahawks did start 3-0 before getting blown out 37-6 at Chicago on Sunday Night Football. That was the first of six games.
Do you remember that game at all?
No, not really.
I don't either.
First of six games missed by Sean Alexander. Then Matt Hass was injured in a 31-13 home loss to Minnesota in week 7 that I attended in a field suite. And most memorably remember Chester Taylor running away from me in a 95-yard touchdown in that game. Including that game, the Seahawks went 2-3 without Hasselbeck, who returned for the Monday Night Football snow game against Green Bay, a 34-24 win with Alexander rushing 40 times for 201 yards.
There we go.
In far and away his best game of the season.
Who started in his place? Is that Seneca Wallace?
Yep.
That was like Seneca Wallace starting in the Seahawks going 2-3 during that time period was definitely a, like, be careful what you wish for type situation, where we all loved Seneca Wallace and sort of wanted him to be the quarterback, and then when it happened, it wasn't as thrilling as it seemed like it was going to be.
I did not want him to be the quarterback. I was perfectly happy for him to play wide receiver a few times a game. He actually was not really any worse than Hasselbeck, though. Hasselbeck that season, a 54.1 QBR, Seneca Wallace, a 49.3 QBR.
Huh.
And I had the third Pelton brother, Ben Baldwin, run the EPA splits. And the Seahawks were like had really terrible splits when they had just Hasselbeck or just Sean Alexander. And then weirdly, if you took both of them off the field, that was actually their best EPA split. So
it was when they had neither Sean Alexander nor Matt Hasselbeck?
Yeah, it was the Seneca Wallace Mo Morris combo.
Wow.
Mo Morris right, that season averaged more yards per carry than Sean Alexander, who dropped from, in his MVP season the previous year, 5.1 yards per carry to 3.6.
Well, this was his last season with the Seahawks, correct?
Yeah, he had one more. There was one more.
Oh, boy.
It went quick for Sean Alexander. Anyways, the Seahawks lost three in a row in December, including back-to-back home losses to San Francisco and then San Diego on Christmas Eve, before winning their season finale at Tampa Bay to clinch the NFC West at 9-7. Hosted the 9-7 Cowboys as the number 4 seed because the NFC was very bad in 2006. So this was the game we rewatched thanks to third Pelton brother Zach Whitman, who, by the way, did I mention this off the top? You please go listen to the NFL draft preview we did with Zach before Thursday, before the draft, if you haven't already. So the Seahawks trailed that game 20-13 in the fourth quarter. And they failed on a 4th-and-1 at the goal line, but then immediately afterwards got a safety and then drove for the go-ahead touchdown, a 37-yarder to Jeremy Stevens, his second in the game, to take a 21-20 lead with 4:24 left in the game. Cowboys marched down to the Seahawks 2 with 1:19 left. And so here's a couple of things from that sequence that I'd forgotten, because this is the one thing everyone remembers. First off, they got a first down on the field to the 1 on a completion to Jason Witten. And replay somewhat questionably overturned that call to make it a 4th-and-1 and cause the Cowboys to go for the field goal there, a 19-yard field goal attempt for Martin Gramatica. And then, as everyone remembers, Tony Romo dropped the snap. And then the key to the play, though, because it was 4th-and-1, like, Romo easily could have ran for the first down. He could have easily ran for the touchdown. There was a lot of open field in front of him, but he gets chased down from behind by Jordan Babineau.
Big play, Babs. Yeah. There we go.
So the other thing I'd forgotten about is there's still 1:14 on the clock when the Seahawks take over. Like, the Cowboys have a chance to get the ball back, but Sean Alexander immediately ripped off a 20-yard run to give the Seahawks breathing room, and the Cowboys only got the ball back at midfield with 2 seconds left.
So if they hit that field goal, the first down was actually the worst-case scenario for the Seahawks.
Yes, it was.
That Jason Witten first down. So what I remember from this was UW versus USC.
It was Arizona State. I looked it up.
Sorry, Arizona State. Wasn't Nick Young playing? I swear I saw Nick Young that day for the first time.
Oh, you were such a Nick Young fan. Wow, that is such a random 2007 memory.
Can you go double check this?
I mean, they hosted Arizona State on Saturday, January 6th. They played at USC the previous weekend.
I guess it was later that we saw Nick Easy for the first time.
Double OT loss to USC. Spencer Hawes hit like a game-tying 3 at the end of regulation in that one.
That was the first Pac-12 game with Spencer Hawes, right? He hit that 3.
Yep,
I remember that.
The Arizona State game, the Huskies started 3 freshmen in that game, and none of them were Quincy Pondexter.
Well, they all transferred, right? There's Phil whatever.
Phil Nelson, yes.
Phil Nelson. Adrian Oliver.
Yeah, who ended up being like the nation's like one of the leading scorers in the country at San Jose State.
And I can't remember the other one.
Well, it was Spencer Hawes was the other one. That was the third.
The idea that I would go to a regular season Husky basketball game instead of watching the Seahawks in a playoff game is so unheard of.
I mean,
in 2020.
I did it for the Beastquake.
I can't believe that you did that either, but like now I would do basically anything to not miss a Seahawks playoff game.
And you were there because you had the student season tickets, but I was not there. I was watching this with Chris Smith, third Pelton brother Chris
Smith. At Big John Nizzle's house. I remember hearing the story that when Romo botched the snap and then didn't get the first down, that Chris jumped into Big John Nizzle's arms and said, "Lift me."
This also was the year where we were playing football at Taiyi High School.
Was that 2006? Tackle football at Taiyi High School? We were playing at Chinook Middle School.
Okay. Sometimes at Taiyi.
We mostly only played at Chinook. Man, there is nothing more fun than playing tackle football. And it dangerous.
Extremely dangerous at hindsight.
But it was very fun. I feel like the playing tackle football is sort of, you know, people argue that the helmets make things worse. And, like, you definitely don't tackle as hard.
It sounded like there was going to be a butt there, but there just never was.
No, that's it. It was so much fun. Playing tackle football is great. It was. Every time period that I've had where I've consistently played a sport weekly or whatever is always the best time period.
What about when you've consistently coached a sport weekly?
That, too. So this is podcast content. I do want to say about Romo, though. Pretty heady play by Tony Romo.
Yeah, he didn't panic in that situation.
I mean, he immediately started running for that. Like, whatever, people drop snaps. Like, I feel like you can't really hold that against him. It's a thing that could – it's a random thing that could happen to almost anybody.
He also probably should not have been in that role. He was the starting quarterback. Like, what a strange thing.
It's crazy, too. Can you imagine Russell Wilson?
Well, I mean, he had taken over for Drew Bledsoe midseason, which had never happened to Drew Bledsoe before.
Imagine the trick plays, though, if Russ was the holder for the Seahawks.
I missed the two-point conversion they failed to convert after that Jeremy Stevens touchdown. People were saying it was like the Russell Wilson two-point conversion against the Packers in the NFC Championship game.
Really?
Although obviously it didn't work. They failed it. Had they converted it, the field goal would have only tied the game.
Oh. Just situationally, it was like the same. It wasn't I think
what happened. It just didn't work this time because it was Matt Hass doing that and not Russ, which never should have worked in fairness when Russ did it. So the Seahawks then went on to play at Chicago, the number one seed that year, who went on to play in the Super Bowl and lose to the Colts, losing 27-24 in overtime. And I do not remember a single thing about this game.
Man, you don't. We were also at Big John Izzo's house, and I distinctly remember it was one of those situations where, like, I think late in the second half, and I've thought this a couple times, where you get that inkling where you're like, oh shit, we're gonna win, you know? You're like,
you
the
always want to reject that feeling.
Oh yeah, and I do. I mean, I definitely had it in Super Bowl 49, where it was a moment where I was like, we're gonna be back to back champions. How am I gonna respond to this? And I mean, I've been in wins also, but it's when that thought creeps into your mind, you know that something bad is about to happen.
Never had it in Super Bowl 48. The Seahawks went up 24-21 on a Sean Alexander 13-yard TD with 4:57 left in the third quarter. The only score of the fourth quarter was a Robbie Gould 41-yard field goal with 4:24 left to tie the game. The Seahawks were near midfield, or across midfield, I should say, late in regulation before a Tank Johnson sack on 3rd and 10 ended their drive. The Seahawks had the ball first in overtime, but picked up only a single first down. The Bears then got a 49-yard Gould field goal to win it.
Now, see, what you're going to want to do is when you win the coin toss, you're going to want to let them know that you're going to score.
No, don't do that. All right, let's talk about UW men's basketball, not the 2006-07 season. We're going to talk about the 2005-06 season, part of which we talked about last year when we inducted Brandon Roy into the podcast Hall of Fame.
By last year, you mean last week. It has last only week. Been a week
somehow. No, it's not that. Oh, boy.
People are protesting stay-at-home orders. It has been a full year.
Oh, boy. The Huskies lost Nate Robinson to the NBA draft, surprising early entrant who went in the first round. And then Will Conroy and Trey Simmons as seniors from the 2004-05 team that was the number one seed and started out the season unranked, but then began the season 11-0, including a 99-95 win that we talked about last week over number six Gonzaga to climb as high as number seven in the rankings before losing in double overtime to Arizona on New Year's Eve in a game that Roy fouled out of.
New Year's Eve. That was, yeah. I'm telling you, that was the best college basketball game I've ever been to.
My best is UW beating undefeated Stanford in 04.
It was fun. Like, the way that the game was going back and forth was fun.
I get it. Huskies went 13-5 in Pac-10 play, finishing second behind UCLA. They swept the Bruins home and away, but were swept by Wazoo.
Tony Bennett's Wazoo, right?
I think that still might have been Dick Bennett. I guess that probably would have been Tony Bennett by that point.
I mean, this was the period where Wazoo was really good.
It was not quite the period where Wazoo was really good yet.
So this is before then, before they had dude with the long hair?
They had Derek Lowe.
Derek, I was going to say Derek Lowe.
I'm sure they would have had him by this point, but I think he might have been a freshman. I have to look this up. Yeah, they went 11-17 that year.
Oh,
they went 4-14 in Pac-12 play. It was Dick Bennett's last year. Half of their conference wins came against Utah.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
Oh, no. Derek Lowe was a sophomore on that team, as was Kyle Weaver. Aaron Baines was a freshman. Not really anyone to note about. Their leading scorer was sophomore Josh Okoyan. I feel like Katie once danced with at a party. Does that remember
that
correctly?
True. Yes. On the Palouse.
Oh, boy. That is a memory.
She was drinking a Natty Light, dancing with Josh Okoyan. Oh, 2006.
They started this the year. Yeah, they started with two wins against Arizona State. They also beat Arizona State in that homestand, and then one at UW. And then the rest of the year, they had two conference wins. UW was their only conference win the rest of the year. That can't be. No, two conference wins. Yeah. So disappointing there. Anyways, the Huskies then in the Pac-10 tournament upset 84-73 by Oregon in the opening game after finishing conference play on an 8-game winning streak, and land as the number 5 seed in the East Regional. The first weekend playing, I believe, in San Diego, beat Utah State 75-61, and then number 13 Illinois 67-64 in one of the better Husky NCAA tournament games that I don't think gets remembered at all.
I went to the zoo that day. Is that right? Did we fight about this, or did Chris go to the zoo? There was somebody went to the zoo, and then we got that Chinese food from the place on like 105th, and then kind of comfortably beat Illinois. And that was the Illinois team who it was a year after they'd lost Darren Williams, right?
Correct. The year after they'd lost in the championship game to North Carolina. So they still had D. Brown from that team, James Augustine.
Yeah, they had the guy who looked like Atmosphere. It's James Augustine. But it was still a pretty deadly Illinois team.
Yeah, I mean, they were 13th in the country. They were the 4 seed. I mean, it was a great matchup.
And that was an excellent win for UW, and brought on the always fun matchup against UConn.
Yeah, love to play UConn in the Sweet 16 round. So this time it was number 2 in the country, UConn, the top seed in the East Regional, playing in D.C. Jamal Williams had 27 points in that game. Is this thing I did not know? All right, so the Huskies, Brandon Roy got his third foul on a double technical with Rudy Gay at the 13:55 mark of that game.
Pissed about it since last week, still pissed.
It probably was a double technical.
A double technical shouldn't count as a personal foul. It doesn't matter if it's a double technical.
Correct. Then he got his fourth foul 16 seconds later. The Huskies were up 6 at the time. And I can't figure out exactly when he returned because they don't have substitutions in the college play-by-play, but it looked like the Huskies' lead was down to 2 points at that point. So then the Huskies were up 4 when Mike Jensen, in the final 30 seconds, fouled Marcus Williams for a 3-point play in a situation where he would have been just better off letting him go. Huskies
that was my neighbor, Mike Jensen, by the way.
That is true. Huskies then made 2 free throws, so it's a 3-point game. Can you remember who hit the tying 3-pointer?
Oh my God. Not. I want to say, like, Sheldon Brown. That's.
Denim Brown is the guy you're thinking of, who was a Sonics draft pick, but it was not him. It was Rashad Anderson, who had 2 3-pointers in the final 30 seconds of the game, 5 of 10 from 3, 19 points off the bench in that game. Ryan Appleby, this I didn't remember, just watching the highlights. Actually, Ryan Appleby got a pretty good look at the buzzer to win that game. But then the Huskies never led in overtime and lose that game to UConn 98-92. UConn goes on to be upset by number 11 seed George Mason in the regional final.
So if we would have won this game, we would have played George Mason.
That's what I'm telling you.
With a chance to go to the Final Four. It's just... This was the last time for UW basketball that I really remember feeling like an actual contender for a championship. It was this year. They had good teams after that, but it never felt in those moments like, yes, this team can win a national championship.
I mean, it was just because Brandon Roy was so good, he could have put you on his back at that
point. I mean, he basically did. UConn was one of the best teams in the country when they were playing them.
They were, yeah. They were a bit inconsistent, for sure. But
I mean, they have players still in the NBA.
Yeah.
There can't be that many players from that draft class who are still in the NBA.
There are definitely a few of them. I'm looking at the win shares leaders because I was curious if Brandon Roy was up there, which he isn't. Paul Millsap led the NCAA and win shares that year.
Wow, got drafted really low, right?
Yeah. Oh, he was someone stats people loved. Paul Millsap. There was like some moment during the draft where I thought the Sonics had drafted him, but they didn't, and that was a disappointment. Instead, they drafted Denham Brown. He did not make the NBA. So speaking of the Sonics,
they could have drafted Paul Millsap, and they drafted Denham Brown.
Like, Millsap might have gotten the pick before them. I mean, obviously, they could have drafted Paul Millsap, given where he went.
I guess it's good that they moved then.
Now you're in. Millsap went with pick 47. The Sonics put Denham Brown with pick 40. A pick before James Augustine.
Cool.
But three picks after Bobby Jones. Did you just, like, throw some stuff? Speaking of the Sonics, they were unable to replicate their 2004-05 success. Nate McMillan left for Portland on July 5th, 2005, the day after the Sonics re-signed Ray Allen. They promoted his...
What day did the sale happen?
July 18th. But this is a year later. This is all in 2005. This is going into the 05-06 season.
Okay. So he had no idea about that?
No. Yeah, okay. Definitely had nothing. What he knew is that it looked like he was probably going to get fired during the season going into it. The Sonics front office did not have any faith in him going into that season where the Sonics won 52 games and around in the playoffs. So, and he was like a really coveted free agent. So the Blazers made him, he might have been the highest paid coach or like the second highest paid coach in the NBA when he went to Portland. It was so weird. Like, I remember I was at the preseason game that we played in Portland in 05, and Nate being there, it was bizarre. And then there was a press conference when he came back for the first time. And that was like, the Blazers were also in a real rough patch at that point. They hadn't drafted Roy, obviously, or LaMarcus Aldridge yet. And they were still in the era where they were like super paranoid about the media coming out of the Jailblazers era. It was not a great time in Portland, but Nate turned things around.
Nate turned around, as he does. Who was running the Sonics at the time? Jerry Krause? Like, how do you not lock up Nate McMillan long term? He's played his entire career for the Sonics, becomes the head coach of the Sonics, leads them to their best season since the mid-90s when he was a player on the team. Like, how do you let Nick McMillan go in that moment?
I mean, it would be interesting to go back and ask people now, because I don't remember what the reporting was at the time. I mean, they obviously offered him a contract. They didn't want him to leave. I don't know if they were going to pay him as much as the Blazers were. They certainly did not spend as much as the Blazers did at that in that point in the franchise's history.
No, they would never. They were hemorrhaging.
But it was not. I mean, they were.
Nobody will ever make money owning a professional basketball team.
It was not like they were like Phil Jackson. You go 82-0 and you're not coming back. It was not like that. So the Sonics promoted assistant coach Bob Weiss to replace him. retained most of the 2004-05 core despite virtually all of the key players being free agents, losing Antonio Daniels and Jerome James, who, as we mentioned, got the bag from the Knicks. But it wasn't the same, particularly on the defensive end of the court. The Sonics started the season 1-4 and were 13-17 when Weiss was fired on January 3rd and replaced by Bob Hill.
Really, when you factor in that they were, because they still had to pay him the contract, right, Bob Weiss?
Yeah.
Just pay Nate McMillan. Instead of having a coach that you're paying a little bit less, when you add Bob Hill plus Bob Weiss's contracts together, they probably were equaling Nate McMillan's contract, right?
No, probably not.
Really?
I would bet against that. I mean, we never really find out about coaches' contracts, but I would bet heavily against it.
Oh, this is not like publicly available information.
No.
Oh, there's no basketball reference with coach contracts.
And wouldn't it be great if there was? But Weiss, I mean, they did not have. These are not guys that had like a lot of leverage like Nate did. So they dropped as low as 15-24 before that double overtime win at Phoenix. As we've talked about many, many, many times on this podcast, the same day.
The only thing we talk about
is the NFC Championship game.
The fabulous 2005 victory at Phoenix cast.
January 22nd, 2006. That's where it just, that life peaked then. On Valentine's Day, the Sonics traded Vlade Radmanovic for Chris Wilcox, further breaking up the core. And then a couple weeks later at the trade deadline, traded away Reggie Evans, Flip Murray, and Vitaly Potapenko, landing Earl Watson in a four-team deal. Watson solidified a defense that was the worst in NBA history to that
point.
This
was re-landing Earl Watson, right?
Yes, bringing him back. He had been drafted by the Sonics in the second round.
And he
played one year.
One year before signing with Memphis.
Yeah, before leaving as a restricted free agent. So most people, like everyone knew the Sonics defense was bad, but no one actually knew how bad it was until, and I looked this up, on April 1st, John Hollinger, my predecessor at ESPN, published a column noting that relative to league average, they had the worst defense in NBA history. And I remember this like being so shocking to people that the PI's beat reporter at the time, Gary Washburn, who's now at the Boston Globe, like they asked him to go like interview every player and ask them about being the worst defense of all time.
Wow. So I like that you and John Hollinger is sort of one after another at ESPN were on the two different sides of that Grizzlies-Sonics trade.
I mean, he was like 12 years from... And Watson wasn't on the Grizzlies at that point.
He was one whole grit and grind away from working with the Grizzlies.
A lot of grit. Watson at that point was playing for the Nuggets, who just had too many point guards. They had Earl Boykins and Andre Miller, so they had too many point guards named Earl. The Sonics went 14-13 the rest of the way after adding Earl Watson, but still finished 9 games out of a playoff spot. The highlight of the season. In the season's final game, Ray Allen set the NBA single-season record with 269 three-pointers, beating Dennis Scott's record of 267, and no one would ever make that many three-pointers again. And actually, it stood 7 seasons before Steph hit 272 in 2012-13, and so I was also there to see Steph break the record, so I saw two back-to-back record-setting three-point single-season marks.
Was that in Portland that he said it?
Or yeah, their season finale was in Portland.
Ah.
UW football made
now,
progress.
Now most centers and power forwards hit 272 threes.
It's still pretty high up there.
Michael Kidd-Gilchrist hit 275 last year.
Look, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist hits 275 threes.
So that Sonic season, I mean, we talked about this being basically the end of professional basketball in Seattle, and obviously we'll talk about Durant when he played here, but like, not re-upping Nate, where you have to assume you're getting some sort of hometown discount of some kind, you know?
I think they probably were at the opposite position at that point.
Because of what? Because Nate just didn't feel confident in the front office?
Yeah. And he didn't feel like they had his back.
It is...
Which I don't think they were wrong to like be down on Nate McMillan. I was pretty down on Nate McMillan as a coach going into the 04-05 season.
Wow.
Like, the Sonics hadn't been that good.
How many years was he the coach? How much talent did he have?
He had been 3.5 years on the job going into that point. I mean, like, if he wasn't Mr. Sonic, he would have been fired in the summer of 2004.
He still had an excellent season. I'm just saying, this shines more on the front office than it does on Nate McMillan. And, like,
sure, I don't blame Nate for leaving.
You look at it and you're like, wow, Nate McMillan was fucking prescient when he did this. You're like, he went to Portland right before Portland was going to get a lot better. And before the Sonics were going to move, it was like, Nate comes out the winner in the entire situation. But when that season started, everything just felt flat. It was just like, something is wrong. Right? Especially the hiring of Bob Weiss as the coach, where you're just like, I mean, sure, Bob Weiss is fine, right? But, like, this man's an assistant coach. He's not, there's nothing exciting about Bob Weiss. You're like, he'd been the coach of the Hawks in the early 90s or whatever. Like, there was nothing new or interesting about it at all. The team looked mostly the same, but just didn't quite feel right. I wonder, in hindsight, we both kind of liked Chris Wilcox and Vlade, but, like, the team wasn't that different. It was just something felt wrong.
I mean, part of it was they probably got, like they overachieved in 04-05. Like, they weren't that good in 03-04. They had mostly the same players then, too.
Did they overachieve statistically in 04-05, though?
Not really, like, in terms of point differential, I think a little bit, but it wasn't like they were, like, a 41-win team.
I don't think Nate was coaching the worst defense of all time.
No, that was part of it. I mean, Nate has shown a tremendous knack for cobbling together okay defenses from bad talent.
And that's maybe all you needed if you have a good offense.
But, like, the thing to remember is, like, Ray was super excited that Bob Weiss would replay the same Nate.
Okay.
Like, Ray and Nate did not necessarily see eye to eye. But I think they eventually came to him, much like the front office probably came to appreciate Nate in his absence, because it turned out they needed someone getting on them all the time, because then they might actually play a little defense, just a little.
This was a bad season, though. It's just, I don't know, there was something about 2006 where in a lot of ways it was like... We had it so good in 2005 and in a lot of different sports scenarios, and 2006 was definitely the hangover year from that.
That's a good way to put it. It was like you after drinking a lot of Cloudburst beer. UW football made progress in 2006. They started the season 4-1 with their lone loss coming at number 15, Oklahoma. Beat both San Jose State and Fresno State by single score margins, but then beat UCLA and won at Arizona to start Pac-10 play. This is like, it's funny. Obviously, I had gone to UW. I did not have season tickets when I went to UW, which is just mind-boggling in hindsight, but, like, I preferred watching the games on TV because that's how I'd always done it as a kid.
You're going to love this next year.
Well, this... No, 2 years later. Next year was okay.
No, I meant this upcoming football season.
Watching all the games on TV. Wow. Well, I'll be happy if we just have games to watch on TV. This was the first year we started really going to games. You and Katie started really going to games.
This was my second year. And look, I saw back-to-back horrible Oregon State losses.
Yeah, so the previous year was the driving rain. This year the weather wasn't so bad. But we got to talk about that Arizona. Well, the UCLA game was really fun. There was, like, I feel like there was a blocked field goal.
Katie was drunk under the seats in that UCLA game.
That also was fun.
Yes, where it was like the fourth quarter, and Katie was like, I think it was after that block, Katie was like, what are we cheering for? She got up from under the seats. It was like deep into the game that Katie was still incoherently drunk. I think it might have been because of that Sonics tailgate.
I have no comment on this issue.
Was that 2006? Look, the team doesn't exist anymore. You're fine.
I can't remember the exact timetable, whether it was 2006 or 2007, but that would make sense because we weren't like tailgating on our own necessarily at that point. The Arizona game also was very bizarre because in 2006, they would play a road game and it just wouldn't be on TV. So we went to Heck Ed to watch the game off the Arizona video board broadcast of the game. It's like every third down, bear down, they'd be playing that graphic on the screen. But they did not bear down sufficiently.
Wasn't it?
I think it was on a Saturday.
Saturday night?
I think it was on a Saturday. They did not bear down sufficiently in that one, as the Huskies got the 21-10 victory to go to 4-1. And we're feeling pretty excited because, like, this team has been bad for a while now. And
didn't they got up to being ranked number 25 in the country? Is that right?
No, they were never ranked.
Okay, maybe that was a different time. Maybe that was during Coach Sark's first year. This is after they beat USC.
Okay, they had lost the next week. Yeah, the next week they play USC and lose 26-20. Like, they're competitive against a USC team ranked third in the country, although this was not one of Pete's best USC teams. John David Booty started that one at quarterback.
Still, he had them ranked number three in the country.
I mean, obviously, they were like all five-star guys. These just weren't, like, historically good all-star guys.
They probably had a brutal loss at Oregon State or something.
Probably. And then the following week at 4-2, Huskies come home to play Oregon State, and that's where Isaiah Stanbick suffers a career-ending, at least college, Lisfranc injury.
So Oregon State.
That was bad. Because Stanbick had been pretty good that season, and then Carl Bunnell came in and was not good, as it turned out.
Loved Isaiah Stanbeck.
Oh, Isaiah Stanbeck, one of our all-time favorite UW QBs.
And then what about the Cal game that year also?
Well, so let's talk about Carl Bunnell, who completed 44% of his passes for 5.6 yards per attempt, 11 interceptions in 164 attempts.
Wow.
It was not good. So the Huskies then go on. After that USC game, including that, they lose their next six conference games to drop to 4-7 before beating Wazoo in the Apple Cup 35-32. But still did have some competitive moments in there, including, as you mentioned, that Cal game, which they tie on the final play, a 40-yard, essentially Hail Mary, from Carl Bunnell to Marlon Wood to force
Marlon Wood. I was going to try to guess who that was. I remember freaking out. I think we were at your house watching that game when Katie was living there and freaking out at that Hail Mary.
That is correct. In hindsight, the Huskies should have gone for two there. Should have tried to win it in regulation. Carl Bunnell threw five interceptions in that game. Wow. But the star of that game was a young man named Marshawn Lynch, who had 21 carries for 150 yards and two touchdowns, four catches for 53 yards, scored a 22-yard touchdown in overtime to win it. And then got on the cart and drove around.
It was the greatest Seattle moment in that year.
It was
the best thing to happen in Seattle sports in all of 2006.
I mean, it depends on kind of the Tony Romo fight, but maybe that was the high point. But that was and by the way, the low point for the Huskies also involved a future Seahawk. A loss to 0-9 Stanford. I mentioned last week I thought you could pinpoint the actual low point in Seattle sports because I was thinking this game happened in 2008. It was actually this season. So Stanford comes in again 0-9, has not won a game.
This is a pre-Harbaugh Stanford, right?
Yes. Yes. Beats the Huskies, getting a 74-yard touchdown from some receiver named Richard Sherman.
Pretty wild. God, I wish we could just, like, go back to that moment for 1 second.
No, don't Richard go Sherman back. Was. Go back. I mean, it was also
but just for a second, like,
cold.
How much fun would that be?
They beat the Huskies 20-3. Yeah, I mean, if you knew what Richard Sherman was going to be, what he was going to do, it would be wild.
Or, like, we were probably pissed off. I don't even remember Marshawn Lynch really driving on the card, except for the highlights now, where I think it's awesome every time.
But I mean, like, I remember it because I didn't get that bobblehead at the Cal UW game, and it haunts me to this day.
It's really the worst thing that you've ever done. But, like, at the time, we probably would have been pretty pissed about that, Marshawn Lynch driving around in the car, and now I'm just like...
I mean, we were happy just to be there.
It's just kind of amazing how differently you can think about things over time, and how much context matters.
So the 5-7 record was still the Huskies' best record during the period between 2004 and 2009, tied their best record. I mean, the one thing, I think Tyron Willingham gets a little bit of an unfair rap in that team was as good as some of the Sark teams that went to bowl games. It's that they were massively overscheduled at that point. And the Pac-10 was really good back then. So their strength of schedule was incredibly high.
Yeah, in the modern Pac-10, they'd be, like, second place.
And then Stanbeck got hurt, so, like, that was actually a good team. Now, What happened after that with Tyrone Willingham, we'll get into in future years. 2006 saw the Mariners progress towards respectability. They went 78-84, despite a step back from Felix Hernandez, who went 12-14 with a 4.52 ERA in his first full season with the Mariners. A notable moment from that year, Jamie Moyer traded to Philadelphia in August at age 43, a decade after being traded to the Mariners. He then went on to pitch an additional four seasons for the Phillies, plus part of 2012 for the Colorado Rockies.
I definitely had him in fantasy baseball at some point, like in his mid-40s. I've started him.
All right, wrapping up Seattle sports, the Storm took a step backwards in 2006 due to Lauren Jackson's injuries. She played 30 of 34 games, but was limited to a then-career low 28.4 minutes per game. The Storm dropped to 18-16 and lost in three games to the LA Sparks in the opening round of the playoffs. Should we talk about music?
Absolutely.
Should we talk about Crazy?
Sure.
I mean, I have like such a specific memory. So 2006, we mentioned last year that like academic year 05-06, you lived with the famous cousin Katie. And I have like such a specific memory of driving to that house on a Friday afternoon when it's sunny outside during the summer, listening to like Q was probably playing Crazy every other song at that point, I would imagine.
On Cube? It was being played on every station. That's the thing about Crazy is
it was a crossover hit.
It wasn't Q music, it was Kiss 106 music also, right?
They were probably playing on the end just because.
Absolutely they were. I think it probably was being, I mean, that song was so big that it was all over the place. And like 2006 was, did I mention this before last week? I feel like this was the first year that I remember there being a song this summer.
Well, you mentioned it in 2005.
About Feel Good Inc.
But 2006 was much more clear, much more definitive. And I also associate that with that summer. My other big memory is, it's sports, but not Seattle sports, Italy winning the World Cup.
Oh, fuck!
You forgot about that?
I do have to say, man! Because we're talking about Seattle sports, which were awful in 2006. But let's talk about the summer of 2006 in a second.
Okay. What should we talk about now?
Nothing. No,
we're just gonna pause. Well, okay. So there was a Crazy moment. Uh-huh. There was also, and this was not necessarily as strong, but longer lasting in some ways. The girl talk moment.
The girl talk moment was one of the most thrilling things that happened on the internet. Like. I had a CD of Night Ripper, which is insane that they actually made this CD from Illegal Art Records, where it was like all of these sounds. It was so 2006 too, where you're just like, girl talk is taking classic rock and pop music and indie rock and hip hop, and it's all in one. And it was like mashups.
All the things I like.
Mashups were so exciting. Like if I heard a mashup right now, I would bash my computer. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I want to hear that less than I want to hear any music on earth. But in 2006, it was the most exciting, coolest shit we had ever heard.
It was futuristic.
Right? And when we'd heard Biggie mashed up with Tiny Dancer, with the original Blow Up Like the World Trade line, that was like the coolest thing that we'd ever heard in our entire lives, right? Like that moment, if you could sum down all of girl talk, right? Because there's so much going on. It just distills down to finding basically maybe the greatest rap verse of all time in Juicy, and then putting it against like a classic rock song, which was also huge from fucking Almost Famous right before then, and having these two things together, right, and it was the most exciting thing. What?
I think Almost Famous came out in 2000, didn't it?
But it was like a song that was more in the zeitgeist because of Almost Famous. That's how I knew Tiny Dancer, right? Okay. Like, it was a song that had a second life because of that. And those two things happening at the same time. Like, I don't remember caring about Juicy before then. And after that, I was like, oh, like, I went back and listen till Ready to Die because of Girl Talk. It was like Girl Talk was changing hip hop that had come before. We were discovering things because of it. And I'm like, oh, what's this sample? What's that sample? Right? Like, it was so exciting.
That's interesting. Cause I think a lot of the appeal of Girl Talk and Night Ripper specifically is like everything was so familiar.
It's both. It's the familiar matched up with maybe the unfamiliar. And you're like these little bits where you're like, oh, where's that from? Right?
There was another moment in 2006.
This was iPod music.
Yes.
This is music that sounds good on an iPod.
The other moment of 2006 was the hyphy moment.
Did that end?
I mean...
You have Marshawn Lynch playing at Cal.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, what a great time for the East Bay. Tell Me When to Go from E-40.
I ain't got dreads, but I'm thinking about growing some.
I mean, what a moment. I also, for some reason, weirdly connect this to The Girls Next Door, because there was one point where they were ghost riding the whip on that show. I don't know why that connection is in my head, but it is. The other moment that we had in 2006.
Yes.
Justin Timberlake with Future Sex Love Sounds.
Yeah, that kid from NSYNC really made good.
I mean, so many hits off that album.
He had Cry Me a River before then, but it was like, when Future Sex Love Sounds happened, it was like, oh, this person's a bona fide, like, major pop artist. He reached the pantheon. For that moment, I don't know if it's necessarily lasted, but, like, we were looking at Justin Timberlake as a, like, Michael Jackson, Prince-level pop artist, right?
For sure, yeah.
It's like, this is thrilling. So 2006 also, for me, was the year that I got back into, because I was indie rap basically all of the 2000s until 2006. And we were, again, at Katie's house, at your current house in Boulevard Park, watching the BET Awards. And I heard for the first time ever, it'd probably been out for way too long, What You Know by T.I. And I was just like, oh, shit. I was like, what's going on over here? I was like, there is thrilling music happening. And it was like, What You Know About That, that changed everything. And that whole The King album by T.I. I was like, I got the burn the CD from some place or whatever. And the first second of it, I was like, oh, T.I. is fucking incredible. And it was definitely like, I think since then, I had like a 10-year moment of being back interested in like more mainstream rap music because of T.I.
Really? Wow. T.I.
Or like I was more interested in like rap music and not like indie rap.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
It was also, I mean, we have... maybe aside from, I don't know, aside from a few things, but Hell Hath No Fury by Clips, which was like, you know, it was pitchfork rap music, but it wasn't indie rap in basically any way, right? Like Hell Hath No Fury, the level that Pusha T and Malice were at for that album, and plus Pharrell, right? Like all of those coming together, it was like it came out of fucking nowhere, right? I never heard Clips before Hell Hath No Fury. And then it was like, boom, it slapped you in the face. It was like, here's your blog music, blog boys.
Sure.
2006, though, in general, I feel like there were things that were exciting at the time but didn't necessarily last forever. Whereas, like, yes, like, we liked Gnarls Barkley or whatever. Like, things that were really thrilling, but now when I look back at them, I'm like, they're Hell Hath No Fury aside. Like, it doesn't quite hold up, but one that does hold up. Songs for Christmas by Sufjan Stevens.
I mean, that's definitely the most lasting impact of any album released in 2006, without question. I will continue to listen to that until Sufjan puts out a new non-electronic Christmas, like,
Volume 2, really, it didn't hold up in the same way. Like, Sufjan's trying stuff out. We just wanted more traditional Christmas music. And the moment where he was
more original, but sounds traditional.
Yes.
Or at least, like not, you know, I don't know.
The age of odds, Sufjan is not. I would be curious about the age of odds. Age of odds, Sufjan is not necessarily perfect for Christmas music. It's perfect for age of odds, but like Christmas music that sounds like it. Not sure about Illinois era Sufjan is perfect for Christmas music.
And correct.
When he was recording like the volume 5 on Songs for Christmas, holds up like these to us, to basically nobody else, these are Christmas classics, right? These are canon. These are being played on Warm 106.9 starting the day after Thanksgiving.
I think this got taken out of the Ape Rubyard metrics page, the reference to the Sufjan Stevens song.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Who would have done that?
Well, someone who doesn't know me, clearly.
C-H-R-I-S-T-M-A-S. the year that gave us maybe the worst Jay-Z album in Kingdom Come. Debatable, aside from that one that got downloaded onto our T-Mobile phones.
Look, first off, he said he was going to come back like Jordan wearing the 4-5. The thing is, Jordan lost wearing the 4-5.
He eventually would come back like Jordan wearing the 2-3.
Yeah, but that's it took a little while, just like with Jordan.
It just took a little while. And then a few others that I want to call out. The Life Pursuit by Belle and Sebastian. I was at my all-time Belle and Sebastian high. They played at the Moore Theater, I want to say, in early 2006 with New Pornographers opening. And I'm like meeting up with our aunt Nuggle after, because that's the kind of music that I was listening to at the time. Fish Scale by Ghostface Killah. Kilo is 1,000 grams. It's easy to remember. It's like I always know how many grams a kilo is because of that song. Burial, definitely like along with Girl Talk, inventing internet music. Like without Burial, there's no like the idea of like when The Weeknd started it, nobody knew who it was, right? It was like a secret. Mm-hmm. And without Burial, I feel like that doesn't happen. And internet music where it's like shrouded in mystery even to this day for him. Dog Problems by The Format. Do you know that band is?
No.
The pre-fun lead singer Fun from Phoenix, Arizona. Stand very hard for Dog Problems. Went to go see them at Numo's before Numo's had air conditioning, and it was like a 98 degree day. It was the hottest place that I've ever been in my entire life. Aside from seeing Girl Talk the next summer at Capitol Block Party, which we'll talk about in 2007. Blood Mountain by Mastodon. Boys and Girls in America, the Hold Steady sequel, which not quite Separation Sunday, but it was all right. And then the seminal Jay Reitard album, who unfortunately died too young, Blood Visions. And also in 2006, you might not have known this, Dr. Dre teased the Detox Forever, and it actually came out in 2006. And that album was called Doctor's Advocate by The Game. I'm telling you, this was when I got into mainstream rap music. I distinctly remember, this is the first time that I was living in Redmond, Washington, drinking a 40, because I was routinely drinking 40s in 2006, drinking a 40 and listening to Doctor's Advocate, and it was just like, hell yeah. I was like, this was, in that moment, it felt like we were listening to The Chronic for the first time, hearing that.
Wow.
I was like, The Game, you know, like documentary was good or whatever. Doctor's Advocate, Game put out his best version of a classic Dr. Dre, like Compton record.
I mean, yeah.
Does this not, it doesn't mean anything to you?
Not that much to me.
R.I.P. Okay, so I also have to mention the summer of 2006, which otherwise known as, for Italians, the best summer ever, since Augustus roamed the streets. We had that summer the first ever time in my entire life that I paid attention to soccer. You paid a little bit more attention than me.
I mean, I had paid like a tiny bit of attention in Italy in the 94 World Cup. Had watched, woke up early to watch Italy lose to France in the quarterfinals, I think, of the 98 World Cup on Univision, because it was not broadcast live in English.
That was the one Baggio missed the PK?
Well, I think Baggio missed the PK, and maybe both. Italy lost both of those on PKs.
God.
Suffice it to say. They played a lot of PK. I mean, I didn't pay attention in 2000.
PKs came back.
Yeah, 2002, I didn't really pay any attention just because those games were on in the middle of the night. But 2006, I was ready.
2006, I feel like a lot of things came together for soccer in the U.S. Like, the timing was perfect of those games. It was in Germany. Italy had an excellent squad. They were a fun team, too. Like, this was the most fun Italian soccer team we've ever followed. Obviously, they won the World
Cup. They played the U.S.?
They played the U.S., and I think they drew with the U.S. in the group stage,
correct,
right?
Yeah.
So, rallying around that team, like, that, those weeks from, I want to say, like, mid to late June, like, right when UW ended school, I just finished my first year at UW. I had no job that summer. I literally was doing fuck all. I was going to go see the format at Newmost. Like, that was what I was doing. I was listening to indie rock music and getting hyped on TI and watching Italy play soccer and then drinking some 40s and listening to the game. Like, I have never had a better summer in my entire life. There was
the only point for the U.S. in that group stage.
Great. The Blue Scholars on Bayani have the line about tilting Carlo Rossi back in the summer of 2000, and it's always 2006 for me. In the summer of 2006, we were drinking a lot of Carlo Rossi, right? Because we were proud to be Italian, and for some reason that translated drinking Carlo Rossi. I met Mrs. Fantasy Genius in 2006, and we started dating that summer. It was just like, I remember it being a hot summer. We were like hanging out. We ran in sprinklers one night. We were having cranium parties.
Yeah,
remember
the cranium parties? Of course I remember the cranium parties.
2006 was the perfect summer, and that Italian soccer team beating Germany on July. Was it on the 4th of July?
Yes.
Beating Germany on the 4th of July, which I knew nothing about soccer at the time, but now looking back at it, I'm like, wow, they beat the team that was hosting the World Cup? That's pretty exciting. I mean,
it was a young German team at that point. That was the Jürgen Klinsmann team, wasn't it?
Jürgen. Beating Germany on the 4th of July, then going on and playing in the final again against France, the hated France, and we have one of the most memorable moments in World Cup history, right? With Zidane headbutting Marco Materazzi. And it was like, we were at somebody's apartment, we're at Nick's apartment or somebody's apartment watching that match with a bunch of people. I swear to God, every single one of them was cheering for France, which I don't even know how that came to be. But I remember waking up early that morning. It was sunny outside. It was hot. It was exciting. And then you go to penalty kicks after this crazy moment had happened. And it's like, look, Italy lost a defender and France lost Zidane. You know, so we're feeling pretty good going into it. Also, like, Buffon's not losing this World Cup. And Gigi Buffon winning the World Cup on penalty kicks for Italy. It was the first real soccer moment that I remember paying attention to, and still the best soccer moment that I've ever had.
Yeah, it'd be hard to beat.
Crazy was playing on the radio. We were tilting Carlo Rossi back. It was incredible. I think we're at Billy LeCompte's apartment.
That could be. It was someplace I had never been before and never went again.
Me too. And he was French. Or of French descent, right? So, like, oh, man. God, that was a good summer. Despite all the sports that were not that good. This was also the year that I traveled to Oregon, right? For that road game in Hudson.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been. Because it was the next fall, and it was when I stayed home because the Sonics had the finale of the 40th anniversary tour with the majority of the players from the 40th anniversary team. So there was some event we had in the rain, I think in Beacon Hill, maybe?
It poured rain. That's why I didn't.
Yeah.
And it was the first and only time. You've never really been to Eugene. The first and only time I've ever been to Eugene, and I don't really plan on going back. Look, the Huskies would have to be pretty heavy favorites for me to return to Eugene.
It was a 34-14 loss for the Huskies.
UW looked pretty good early on, and then it all collapsed. And the drive back, because we weren't staying there, and it's not a quick drive, right? It's like, take the Portland drive and add another 2 hours on or something. And that drive back was just terrible in the pouring rain, just feeling crushed about losing to Oregon so badly, not even realizing how many more losses to Oregon were to come.
No.
But that, it was definitely like 2006 was The Hangover 2005. The fall of 2006, going back to school, was The Hangover of 2000 and of the summer of 2006. And we also had, this was the year that Boise State, Chris Peterson, I think it was technically 2007, but that Fiesta Bowl happened. And I remember this was that year that Boise State was so good as well. Jared Zebranski.
Statue of Liberty play because Chris Peterson. He loves trick plays.
Loves trick plays. And this was like the year that all the people we would eventually come to love had great moments for other teams.
I mean, Pete Carroll didn't. As we talked about. The team went, although they went 11-2 and finished fourth. That was still a relative down year for USC to just win the Rose Bowl over Michigan. And they did, in fact, lose at Oregon State 33-31. So there you go.
Extremely quickly, 2006 Bumbershoot lineup. This was the year that Kanye West played Bumbershoot. He'd played Sasquatch the previous year. Blue Scholars opening for Kanye West. It was Kanye, Tribe Called Quest. So I think they had two hip-hop nights, which was pretty exciting. So one night was Blue Scholars going into Kanye. And this was when Blue Scholars like announced that they were doing Mass Line, right, before they'd signed with Ruckus. It was like, I don't think I've ever been as hyped on on a Bumbershoot show. I don't think I had press access. I think the first year I had press access was the next year. I think I just bought tickets this year, but it was like one of the most exciting moments. And then they also had Atmosphere into Tribe as another headliner. Like, that was a very exciting year for what I was into. Really beyond there, it's like, I remember going with Jan to see the Steve Miller Band, Blondie, Spoon, New Pornographers. It was like a lot of stuff that I was very into in 2006.
There was someone named Macklemore who played there?
We didn't mention this, but I do remember in early 2006, I think for Christmas 2005, Jan was just like, buy whatever CDs you want, and I'll give those to you as a Christmas present. And I got The Language of My World by Macklemore. After hearing it was early December 2005 that I'd heard it on KXP, I heard White Privilege, and I was just like, what is this? And then I got that and was like, got very into local hip hop 2006.
In TV saw the debut of 30 Rock, which you'll recall was a poor man's studio.
Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip?
Yeah.
Knockoff.
But proved, of course, much more lasting. And it was great to just welcome Tracy Morgan back into our lives in an even bigger way eventually, I think, probably than SNL.
Yeah, it was before we really knew who Tina Fey was.
No, we knew who Tina Fey was. She had hosted, she had done a Weekend Update.
I guess, well, maybe we did. Tina Fey became a huge star around this time period, though.
Yeah, I mean, she became like the hyphen at that point, the hyphen, you know, because she was like the creator, writer, producer, etc., and the star. I mean, I guess she'd already been the head writer on SNL, too, so that, she was a bit of a hyphen in that one as well. So, yeah, 30 Rock still is high of joke per minute volume as we're ever going to see on television.
Super holds up. If it's still on Netflix, I might watch it today. I'm midway through Community. I might not watch it today. But
you know what I think 30 Rock is on?
What's that?
I think it's on Peacock.
On Peacock?
I think so.
I might watch it never. Wow. That is a harsh joke. On Peacock.
Does that check you out?
I don't know. I've never heard of Peacock.
That's the NBC. NBC streaming. Maybe it's not. No, yeah, it does have. Yeah, they have Peacock. Yeah, that is correct.
Whew. I think it's also on Hulu. You're still crunching the numbers about Peacock over there?
It does not appear to be on Hulu.
You're resetting,
oh, no, it is, I guess.
Resetting your password for Peacock.
It is on Hulu. Okay. Talladega Nights, which is a movie that I saw in the theaters, and I do not think I've ever seen again.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. We saw it together in theaters.
Oh, yeah. We were very excited about this. We were still in the Will Ferrell moment. Another movie I've never seen.
You've
Snakes
never
on a Plane.
Seen? Oh, I went to the theaters. Me and Keelan and Nick went to go see Snakes on a Plane together. And there was like three people in the theater. We had a great time.
That sounds like a great experience.
I remember in 2006 was the first year that I discovered listening to music on MySpace. And, oh my God, what was that band called? Starship something? Oh, man. They had a song in Snakes on a Plane, like the theme to Snakes on a Plane. And I remember first hearing, I listened to Macklemore for the first time on MySpace. MySpace is kind of underrated long-term as a music discovery platform, right?
Makes sense.
Blowing up on MySpace was, this is how we'll talk about TikTok in like 10 years.
Cobra Starship.
Cobra Starship. I remember first hearing about them. And also Gym Class Heroes. Remember that band? They ended up getting huge. I remember hearing about them for the first time on MySpace.
Like, my recollection is the first time I heard about MySpace was when Andrew Bynum was drafted and he had like filled out some questionnaire on MySpace, which, you know, he said embarrassing things because he was a 17-year-old who was about to get drafted.
No, there was some definitely questionable stuff in that questionnaire.
I think that was the 2005 draft, right?
I mean, people had started transitioning to Facebook at this point, but like, Facebook is not a good resource for a lot of things. And like, MySpace for music discovery was excellent in a lot of ways. Like, you could put four tracks up or whatever as an artist. They were right front and center. You could download music from MySpace. Like, it's kind of, MySpace predated stuff like Spotify. It got about halfway there in the iPod era.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like, I'm listening to all this music from 2006, and I'm trying to understand, like, what was I listening to this on in 2006? Because I can't, like, I know I was listening to albums after hearing a song on KAXP, but I have no idea where, and I assume that a lot of it probably was on MySpace.
You think you were listening? I don't know if you were.
To KAXP?
To listening to MySpace.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. Just, I don't know where else I would have been listening to it.
Maybe you're listening to an iTunes. You used to download stuff off, or used to be able to download stuff off Hype Machine. I probably burned you CDs. I definitely.
That was probably a lot of it, but.
Like, I would go on Hype Machine and look at all the top tracks before. I mean, Hype Machine is way different now, but like, you used to be able to just download music off of there. And
where was I listening to Young Folks by Peter, Bjorn, and John over and over and over again because that song is so good?
Yep. That was 2006.
That was 2006.
Man, that group is really testament to the fact that you only need one track.
I mean, I don't think they're the biggest testament to that, but they are a testament to that. The last 2006 movie worth talking about is, of course, Borat.
I do remember the Borat moment. Before then, I'd watch probably around the same time as watching Entourage. The, oh my God, what is that dude's name?
Sacha Baron Cohen?
Yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen had the Ali G show.
Yeah, the Ali G show.
I remember watching that. It was one of those things because I read like Rolling Stone magazine or whatever, and it was like a huge, huge thing in England. But I remember reading about the British Office and whatever. I used to read NME too. Because I would go to read about music. So I'd go to the fucking Berrien Library. Oh my God. I remember reading a review of Belle and Sebastian in NME in the Berrien Library and just being like, what a crazy world is out there. But reading about the Ali G show, and I was like, what the fuck is this? I was like, is it serious? And he would interview like politicians, pretty high level politicians. And it was always unclear if they were in on the joke or not. It was like Sacha Baron Cohen was definitely ahead of his time.
It was pretty clear by the most recent Sacha Baron Cohen show. What was that? Something America, right?
Who is America?
Yeah, that they were not in on the joke.
I mean, I have never seen that, but that's two decades after the Ali G show.
They still were not in on the joke. Can I tell you a 2006 story?
Yeah, absolutely, you can. Look, we're only an hour too.
So Clay Bennett buys the team, and the deal is finalized in October, and he comes to meet like the new employees of his team, the employees of his new team, on Halloween 2006. And my friend Derek is dressed as Ally G for Halloween.
He has a very Ally G look.
He does. He does. It worked for him.
So he met Clay Bennett. Was Clay Bennett in on the joke or not?
No.
Definitely
was
not.
I'm certain he wasn't.
So I remember seeing Borat on the Ally G show or whatever, like as a spinoff from that. And then when it became a thing, it was like, oh, I remember seeing this on this weird show. Flight of the Conchords was another one. Have we talked about that? What year was Flight of the Conchords?
I made a point to look it up at some point. Not until 2007, though.
Okay. Well, we're here. I remember Flight of the Conchords being another one because they had an HBO special and watching them, Brit and Jermaine, and like knowing who they were before the TV show, and it was like, wow, we're in on, you know, this is 2006. You're not looking at their Instagram being like, oh shit, I have not discovered Flight of the Conchords. They have 1.6 million followers. It was like, they have an HBO special and nobody that I know has ever heard of them. Right?
Yes.
I knew nobody else. Like, the Ally G show was a massive television show worldwide, but I didn't know a single other person on earth who'd ever seen it before. And so, like, it felt like it was edgy by watching it. And that was kind of like early Borat felt like that. And then everybody else got in on it and was like, okay. It was like the joke started being a lot less funny, but that first moment of Borat was pretty exciting.
My distinct memory is watching it the Friday after the end of the Sonic season, because like, who had time to watch movies during the season at that point?
Yeah. All right, 2006, best summer I've ever had.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. 2006. It has been remembered. All right. Well, pretty much just the worst of times. Now let's go through the current Seattle sports update. The MLS season has officially been postponed through June 8th. It still seems unlikely it will be capable of opening play at June 8th, but we'll stay tuned. But one event we did have last week was the WNBA draft, the first draft to be held, major draft to be held during the quarantine period. The Storm, in the first round with the 11th overall pick, drafted Latvian wing Katia Laksa. In the second round with the 19th pick, took Texas forward Joyner Holmes. And in the third round with the 31st pick, took Duke guard Haley Gorecki.
Right.
From Coach Dan Hughes said after the draft, the plan is for 2019 first-round pick Ezzie Megbegor to join the Storm during the 2020 season, if possible, which would likely give the Storm a full roster unless one of the rookies can beat out a veteran. Therefore, it makes sense that Laksa, too, is expected not to join the Storm immediately, but instead to come over for 2021 in all likelihood. She's an outstanding shooter who played 3-plus years at the University of South Florida, before tearing her ACL early in their senior campaign, decided to turn pro in her native Latvia with EuroLeague club TTT Riga, rather than returning for a fifth year. Averaged 8 points per game and 2.69 rebounds per game in EuroLeague play, playing against a number of WNBA opponents. Also faced the U.S. women's national team with the Latvia national team, so Sue Bird mentioned that experience as part of the ESPN broadcast talking about Laksa. Holmes is the Big 12 Freshman of the Year and had 14 double-doubles as a senior, but shot just 38% from the field during that senior year. Was molded at Texas by Hall of Famer Tina Thompson, who finished her career with the Storm and was an assistant at Texas during Holmes' first two seasons before becoming the head coach at Virginia. Holmes was suspended for the first semester of her sophomore season due to a school rules violation, so she was not enrolled, I think, even at UT during that semester. Gorecki, in the third round, became the first Duke player to lead the team in points, rebounds, and assists per game as a junior. She's a five-year player who redshirted her second season due to injuries. Really good size for a combo guard, so I think good value for the Storm to get her in the third round.
All right.
UW men's basketball finally got the official news last week that Jaden McDaniels has declared for the NBA draft. No surprise there. He's number 16 on ESPN's latest top 100. Isaiah Stewart is number 26. The other bit of Husky men's basketball news, Elijah Hardy announced his transfer to Portland State.
So
we wish him good luck as a Viking.
Do we think that's because he was basically beaten out at the end of the season by Marcus Sahonis, or?
Yes. Yeah, and it sounds, you know, all indications have been Quade Green coming back, so then that's, you know, going to be hard for him, was going to be hard for him to get a lot of playing time here.
What are our expectations for Jaden McDaniels? If you're running your projections, who does he compare the most to as an NBA player?
I haven't looked at the comparisons yet for this year's draftees, but certainly some significant concerns about his inefficiency offensively at UW, and then also, you know, the spate of technical fouls is a concern, I would say.
Is that actually a concern in the NBA? I mean, really, like...
It's not for the technical fouls themselves, it's so much as what they signify in terms of his ability to manage his emotions on the court, I think, was an issue. Maintain his composure.
I don't know about that. I
think NBA teams think that.
Well, NBA teams are wrong. I think that we're trusting a little bit too much in college basketball referees. Do we feel like there's an avenue for Jaden to look? The idea of him being a star in the NBA is probably out of the question at this point, right? Like, it just, there are so many players ahead of him. But do we feel like he, with his length and his athletic ability, develop into somebody who's a really good, like, 3-and-D guard, small forward?
Sure, yeah. I mean, if he becomes a consistent outside shooter and puts on a little weight, so, you know, he's stronger defensively, then that's certainly well within the realm of possibility.
And you see him going somewhere in the, like, 15 to 30 range? He'll be a first-round pick.
Yeah, I think I'd be very surprised if he didn't go in the first round, but not a lottery guy. In all likelihood at this point, I'd bet against that if you made that the over under.
And it's basically just his limitations as an offensive player and maybe inconsistency.
Yeah, just that he wasn't very good.
He was basically benched at UW.
Yeah. That season did not go great.
Well, I mean, I'm excited to see where he goes. Still think positively about Jaden. In the year that he spent here, he's somebody who, look, it makes sense to go to the NBA at this point. I do wonder if another season at college, if he could have developed into maybe more of a star player, but
I think it would have been a huge risk in terms of, like, it's one thing to excuse one down year in college, but two down years gets harder to write off.
Yes. Yeah. If he's not a star offensive player as a sophomore, then it's an issue.
So speaking of the draft, as we mentioned earlier, we got that draft preview out with Zach Whitman because this Thursday, the NFL, assuming that they can actually get their...
Were there issues during the WNBA draft? They held in a similar situation.
I didn't hear of any. You know, Dan Hughes, in his post-draft press conference, said everything ran smoothly, which apparently was unlike the test run the NFL had for their draft on Monday.
I mean, there are less teams, the WNBA... Maybe the average ages are a little bit younger in the WNBA.
Yeah, I don't know if I would necessarily say that. There has been a younger generation of GMs who've come into the league in the last year or two here, so that probably helped. But also, I mean, I guess the big thing is, you know, in the NFL, you've got staffs of 40 to 50 people who you're going to want to have connected. Pete Carroll talked about that last week on the second episode of Flying Coach with Steve Kerr. The plans that, you know, he'll be able to talk specifically to his offensive coaches, the defensive coaches, you know, various splits like this during the draft is what they kind of envision. Now, in the WNBA, you've got, you know, five or six members of the coaching staff and front office who are, you know, going to be on a call like that.
Interesting.
Members of ownership.
Interesting. How was that episode? I couldn't find it.
It's got its own feed now, the Flying Coach podcast. So check that out. It was a good episode. Pete talked about DK Metcalf and kind of where people went wrong with their evaluation of him. He told a few past draft stories, so that was a good time.
Awesome. So heading into this draft, has anything changed in the last week?
So the Seahawks re-signed Mike Iupati since we last talked, creating additional competition and depth on the interior offensive line. One thing you have to wonder, is this an indication that the Seahawks will move on from Justin Britt and play BJ Finney at center after signing him? Because, you know, they certainly gave him a lot of money to not be starting at one of those two positions.
There's quite a logjam on the offensive
line.
They've
got just so many offensive linemen.
This is great, though. This is what I'm about. Just sign offensive linemen, draft offensive linemen. Let's go. Come on. It's the most important position to have a lot of players at.
I mean, yes, but there's a limit to how many you can have on the roster, so at some point you should probably stop signing them, especially if you can want to draft some, potentially.
Never.
So the Seahawks also this week had Jacob Hollister, Joey Hunt, and David Moore all signed their restricted free agent tenders, so they will officially be back. No surprise there.
So there was a little bit of chatter, basically, because of the Iupati signing and heading into the draft, that we might get a little bit more resolution on Jadeveon Clowney, Everson Griffin. And so far, nope.
I mean, the one theory is that Clowney might wait out the day for a compensatory pick, which I believe is April 27th.
Oh, so we're not that far off.
No, we are not. That's a week from today as we record this.
I mean, I could see the Seahawks for sure at least waiting out Everson Griffin until then, similar to what they did with Ansa last year.
I mean, they're definitely not going to make any move with until Clowney has made a decision. So
why
it's April 27th.
Why does Clowney wait for that?
Well, that might mean more other teams are more interested in signing him because they're not threatening their own comp picks.
Interesting. I don't know, man. It feels like signing Ziggy Ansah as basically like a rehab type story is one thing, but waiting on Jadeveon Clowney, like if you're gonna pay him, you're gonna pay him. Irrelevant. If you're not gonna be that concerned with comp picks, right?
I don't know.
We should end comp picks. Any other thoughts heading into the draft? If you had to make a prediction about what the Seahawks will do with, say, their first two or three picks, both positionally or how they'll use them?
They'll probably pick an overaged run-stuffing defensive end.
Okay.
I feel like, I don't know, I'm protecting myself with the Seahawks here. I'm going to, like, assume they're going to do the worst. I know that they do good things in the draft, too. They did get DK Metcalf last year.
What does the best look like for the Seahawks?
In this specific draft or in general?
In this draft. Like, I mean, their needs aren't glaring anywhere. And the strengths of the draft are obviously wide receiver. Like, do they... Is that the best they can do is take a good wide receiver with the first round pick or whatever their first pick is?
I mean, depends how far you trade back, I guess, potentially, but I feel comfortable waiting until the second round to take a wide receiver.
They never trade back too far, right? Especially with the kind of assets.
Sometimes
they
trade back a couple of times. I mean, there's been a lot of Austin Jackson buzz, it feels like, today.
But is it Austin? Are you really going to draft Austin Jackson when you have this many offensive linemen on the team?
I don't know. Maybe.
Do you need a center fielder? what about AJ Epenesa?
I don't know. Maybe.
It's really tough. I mean, looking at the positions, it's very strange where there's value. I was looking at, I don't know, somebody's draft board, and it was basically like there's no worthwhile tight ends in the first maybe even two rounds. There's very few safeties. It's just strange how that can kind of happen and play out, where, like, positionally, each draft is so different and how the value is in different places. But it really is like, look, in the drafts where there are good players at these positions, just make sure you get one of those players, or two of them even, right? Like, get good wide receivers in the good wide receiver draft. Get good cornerbacks in the good cornerback draft. Right? Don't worry about positions. And I think that to me is the biggest thing about like what a win looks like. So if in their first three picks they end up with a wide receiver, a cornerback, and an offensive lineman, maybe a defensive lineman, I'm pretty happy with that, right?
I'd be much more surprised than you and Zach if they took a cornerback early. I mean, I guess maybe a nickel, but I'd still be surprised.
I don't think you draft a cornerback early to assume that he's a nickel, but
I mean, I think at this point you should. Like, That's a position that is essentially a starting position for 31 teams.
Is there a chance that the Seahawks just go like totally wild? I was looking at that. It's like, could they? Would it be insane of them to draft a linebacker?
Probably, yeah.
Because why? Like, look at how old this linebacking core is.
I mean, they drafted a linebacker in the second round last year, and he doesn't currently have a... I mean, I think he's KJ Wright's replacement, Cody Barton?
Yeah, I suppose they basically are looking at it as Cody Barton is next in line among the young linebackers. I don't know. I just feel like finding the places where there's strength of positions. So I do feel like if they don't draft a wide receiver in day one or two, I think that is... a pretty bad sign.
I mean, also they're going to draft Jonathan Taylor. Oh, Pete does tell a good story about Chris Carson, about how he was like nudging Schneider starting in the fifth round. Like, he's still out there. We would take him.
Schneider's like, yeah. Cool the fuck out, Pete. Running backs will be there in the seventh round.
Nobody's taking this backup from Oklahoma State until the seventh round.
Oh my god.
My favorite part, we got a tweet from Uendur earlier referencing Pete Carroll saying the headline from ComoNews.com, Seahawks competing like crazy to prepare for virtual NFL draft, about always competing. And I liked how in that podcast at one point, Steve Kerr said, there's an old saying, you're either competing or you're not. And it's like, that's not a saying. It's your saying. You can't say that's an old saying.
Steve Kerr said that or Pete Carroll said that?
Pete Carroll said that.
There's an old saying. Oh, I thought Steve Kerr was referencing that. It's like, no. You know, you're either, you know, there's an old saying attributed to Peter Clay Carroll. You're either competing or you're not.
When Pete Carroll, no, but Pete is like throwing that out there as if it's like, you know, something the ancients talked about. Plato is like, you're either competing or you're not.
It's really just like not that good of a saying. Like, I mean, I agree with the perspective of it, but as a saying, it's like not particularly clever or anything, right?
It is when you're talking about John Ryan fake punting when you're up a couple touchdowns in the fourth quarter.
I suppose so. But I'm saying it's not like clever, right?
I mean, it's not a witty thing. It's more just like an aphorism.
And you're either competing or you're not, as handed down from the Greeks. Yeah, absolutely. You're either competing or not.
Wow. It must not be much of a phrase, because when I typed it into Google, Google said, did you mean you're either competent or you're not? Which I did not mean.
Many have questioned with the Seahawks.
And then the first reference is quotefancy.com. Pete Carroll quote, you're either competing or you're not.
Oh my god.
Definitely.
I guess it is doing that. That's definitely like Trump's many people are saying.
It's in Win Forever. So because the first time I remember hearing it is after that Rams game, but it's in Win Forever. And I just must not have remembered it from the many times I've read Win Forever.
Look, there's an old saying. Wow!
Yeah, really? Every reference to you're either competing or you're not on Twitter, on Google, references Pete Carroll saying it. So it's not an old saying. It's a new saying.
I love that he's making it an old saying. If they draft a running back in the first round, I'll get drunk and walk the streets of Renton.
Oh, great.
And we'll talk about it.
Are you going to call up Mike?
I'll call up Mike. I'll be like, Nick Harris is great. We need to talk about this draft pick. We need to talk about Jonathan Taylor. And I'm going to call him Jonathan Taylor Thomas at least once. Anyway, make sure to go ahead and listen to our draft preview podcast with Zach Whitman. It is extremely informative.
We don't talk that much, so that's how you know it's informative.
It was great. Zach's awesome. We hope to have him back post-draft to recap what the Seahawks did in the draft, to talk about Jonathan Taylor from all sorts of different perspectives. So go ahead and check that out, and we're excited to follow that one this weekend, and thank you so much for listening.
Wait, hold on. There's a quote from someone named Terry Perenich, who is maybe a coach of some sort.
Uh-huh.
I think that might be like the you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, Wayne Gretzky, Michael Scott. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Wayne Gretzky, Michael Scott.
An all-time joke.
Man.
I don't know if this podcast was competing or it wasn't.
You never really know. I mean, right. We have like 15 minutes of sports to talk about.
It's true. It's a good thing we talked about 2006 sports for an hour.
Like, that was, nothing is going to compare to July 4th, 2006. Right? Was that the day? We went to that little park and lit off firecrackers with Nancy's? Wow. I can't believe that was 2006. I did not realize that as a 20-whatever-year-old that I was still doing that.